and fed them each day with fodder kept dry beneath a stand of layered branches. Also about the pen she hung woven charms, so as to fend off the beasts of the mountains. Thus it was she baited her trap. The filling of the ravine went far slower than Ilgra expected. It worried her, for winter was nigh, and at least once each winter Vermund would descend for a smallish meal of whatever livestock he could catch. If the gorge was only partially full by the time he came to eat, the wash of water would be insufficient to subdue the mighty worm, and she would have to wait through the winter until the worm's next feeding. Faced with that unpleasant prospect, Ilgra decided to take drastic measures. She went to the spring-fed pool above the ravine, and by the strength of her limbs dug a channel through the full height of the bank that the pool might drain unhindered into the ravine below. The water was less than she needed, but with its addition she had hope the reservoir might fill in time. If Vermund the Grim noticed her work, Ilgra knew he would never be so foolish as to enter the ravine. He was a canny old worm and wary of ambush. Fortunately, the steep-sided flanks of Kulkuras hid the pool from the dragon's burning eyes, and Ilgra felt confident of catching him unawares. Otherwise, her plans would end in fire. 3 moons passed before the stream finally filled the dam, tumbled over the cracked and weathered lip, and continued along its ancestral bed. Winter had settled upon the valley during the third moon, and shingles of broken ice covered the newly formed pool, now dark with shadowed depths. The ice pleased Ilgra. It made the trap that much more dangerous. To further increase the damage the water might cause upon release, she rolled wind-felled trees atop the ice until a thicket of brittle branches adorned the frozen pool. Thereafter, all that was left was to wait for Vermund to bestir himself. It would not be long, she thought, before hunger woke the worm from his evil sleep. In those days, Ilgra kept to her hut, insisting that the Skuggaro come to her whenever possible, lest she find herself too far afield when Vermund finally came thundering down. It was a selfish insistence, and her mother disapproved, but her clanmates never complained, again accepting Ilgra's demand as normal of a shaman. For that, she felt ashamed. But shame could not sway her from her course. Long hours she spent in isolation, sitting and brooding, while she turned her mind to the twisting of words. With each night that passed, she felt more withdrawn, as if she were fading from the world, becoming a wraith haunting the dark pinewood forest. She thought much of her father during those days, of how in winter he sat by the hearth and wove the thulkner, the pattern straps by which the horned display the crest of their clan, and also the lineage of their families, with all the notable deeds ascribed to their ancestors, of how he carved figures of deer and goats and foxes for her and Yana to play with, of how safe she had felt beside him, so large and strong was he. Then, too, Ilgra recalled an evening when she was hardly more than a babe, and her father had returned from the hunt with a doe draped over his shoulder. The eyes of the deer had been so round and soft they had troubled Ilgra, and she had been greatly saddened by the sight. But her father knelt beside her, and he said, "Do not be upset, Ilgra daughter. There is nothing to fear. This is the way of things. Today we feed upon the deer that we may live. In time, our bodies will feed the grass and trees that other deer may live. So it goes. Ilgra had once found the thought comforting. No more, though. Her mind rebelled against the truth of what her father said, insisted that there must be another, better way. Just because something was, did not mean it should always be. The winter solstice marked a break in her self-imposed exile. It was a time of celebration for the Skagaro, as they said a welcome farewell to the shortest day of the year. In the village there was much music and feasting to be had, and feats of strength also, cheered on by the whole of the clan. Ilgra waited out the first part of the festivities in her hut, waited until the light began to fade from the sky, and she felt certain Vermund was not about to fly down. Never yet had he attacked during night, and she doubted his habit was about to change. Regardless, leaving her post by the ravine was worth the risk. She felt in sore need of company. The sounds of song drifting from the village put a pang in her heart. A layer of heavy clouds hung over the valley, and from them fell soft flakes of snow, large and slow. In the muffled solitude, Ilgra trudged from her hut to the village, and thence to her family hall. Along the way, she heard the baying of hungry wolves echoing through the forest. Had she not her staff, Ilgra would have feared for her life. She spent the evening with her mother and Yana, cooking and talking, and enjoying the pleasure of their closeness. Later still, they played games and lamented the length of winter, while outside the flurries of snow thickened into a blinding wall, driven before the relentless, ice-cut wind. Then a shriek pierced the storm-wrapped night, a shriek such as Ilgra had never heard before. At the sound of it, her heart clenched and her bones grew cold, and every bristle on her nape prickled and stood on end. For a moment she could neither move nor breathe, and only when her heart finally jolted back to life was she able to properly react. "What was that?" whispered her mother. And Ilgra knew not. Nothing in Khorjad's teaching had spoken of such a thing. Another shriek louder than before split the wind, and Ilgra shivered from head to toe. She grabbed Gorgoth and sprang to her feet. Before she could take a step, a great black beak stabbed through the roof and struck the hearth fire, spraying sparks and coals in every direction. Again and again the beak struck, snapping and swiping, while a purple tongue lashed with frenzied anger between the two halves. Ilgra shouted and smote the beak upon the side and spoke a word of weirding, Gajla, or light. A ruddy flash blinded her, and with a deafening screech the beak withdrew. Then the hall shuddered, and two sets of huge hooked claws began to rip at the roof, pulling the timbered beams apart. Blasts of swirling snow poured in through the rents. "Run!" shouted Ilgra to her mother and sister, and together they fled the hall. Outside, in the cold and the dark, Ilgra heard more shrieks, and as her blood curdled in her veins, she saw squatting atop the peak of their hall a firelit monstrosity. The creature was grey and hairless and lean as a starveling. Bat wings hung from its shoulders, and at the end of its ropey neck was a gaunt and narrow skull, set with a pair of enormous black eyes, bulging and devoid of white, and then the long dagger of its beak. Across the village, tattered sheets of snow parted to reveal a second monster prowling between the buildings, pecking at the horned as they ran, crimson streaks of gore banding its beak. The creatures reminded Ilgra not of any beast of earth or sky, but rather of beings from ancient legend. The loathsome wretch. Killers of Svarvok's infant sons, eaters of horned, foul shadows that stalked the land of the dead, picking clean the bones of dishonored warriors. Terror poisoned her thoughts. As if in response, the near creature turned its head and darted snake-like toward Ilgra and her family. They ran, and for a brief while the storm hid them. Ilgra heard Arvog and Mokhtar and Rajag and the rest of the warriors shouting as they strove to fight the wretch. Through gaps in the snow, she glimpsed the defenders gathered by torchlight, holding spears pointed toward the oncoming monstrosities. But the creatures were too big and too fast. They towered over even the anointed, and their beaks were like those of cranes, quick and deadly, as they jabbed through the clotted air. Ilgra raised her staff then, and set forth to work what magic she could. But her wielding had no power over the wretch. They were somehow shielded against her words, and all her attacks went awry. Nor could she blind or bind or otherwise slow them. Ahead of her, she saw Elga speared by one of the wretch, speared and eaten. The starveling consuming the Herndal with two gulping motions. Rajag ran forth and was knocked aside with bloody wounds torn across his arms. The familiar heaviness of despair weighed upon Ilgra's heart. There was no stopping the wretch. She looked to Kulkaris, hidden within the baffling smear of the blizzard, and for the first and only time Ilgra wished for the help of Vermund the Grim. And she wondered why the miserable old worm hadn't risen in protest as he had once before. The wind grew stronger until it moaned with dire voice through her horns, and Ilgra realized. The storm had dampened the sounds of the attack, hid the clamor of fear and death within its folds. The dragon could not have heard upon his lofty perch. Ilgra knew then what must be done, though the thought replaced her despair with shriveling fear. With both her hands, she planted Gorgoth upright in the snow, and she spoke a word of wielding to the wind. And for a span, the air grew clear and still. Then, from her knotted belt, Ilgra took her father's horn, and she sounded it with all her hope and might, and the brazen call rang forth throughout the valley. Twice more Ilgra blew upon the horn. Then one of the wretch came crawling toward her, and she allowed the snow to close in around her once again. Yet still no response returned from the crown of Kulkaris, no hint of Vermund stirring, no hope of calamitous rescue. This time the dragon's indifference would be the death of them. Believing her gambit had failed, Ilgra found her family and started with them toward a burrow where they might hide. And then she heard the sound of their destroyer, and for once she was glad. She heard the rumble of Vermund's wrath, and the air convulsed with a jarring thud, and a blast of wind from the dragon's wings swept aside the falling snow in whirls and pennants and twisting braids. In the darkness cleared, the wretch crouched, shrieking with eager hate. They leaped to flight and climbed with startling speed toward the bulky, firelit mass of Vermund descending from above. "Go!" Ilgra said, pushing her mother and sister toward the burrow. But she herself stayed. Not even the threat of death could tear her away. Vermund roared and seared the night sky with flames. Quick as sparrows, the wretch swooped away and flew around either side of the dragon and began to peck and claw at his back. The worm bellowed in pain, tucked in his wings, and dove to ground in a meadow near the village. The creatures followed, harrying him closely, nipping and biting and tearing at his wings. Ildra rose from hiding and started to run toward her hut by the dam. The villagers had fled their halls, and from the cover of the forest, Arvog hailed her, motioned for her to join him. Instead, she lowered her head as if to ram her foes and increased her speed. Behind her, Vermund continued to bellow with pain and anger, cries Ildra had long wished to hear of him, but that now only filled her with dread. She glanced from the dark path before her, checking the positions of the nightmares fighting. The Nretch were faster than the old worm, and they seemed accustomed to contending with dragons, for they knew when to dodge his fire, and how also to avoid his teeth, talons, and tail. Vermund snapped and snarled as he tried to lure them within range of his deadly claws, but the grey creatures were too smart and stayed at a safe distance, moving in only when the dragon's back was turned. The three giants battled across the fields, and the mountains rang with the clamour, a horrendous sound. Gouts of liquid flame sprayed the landscape, and along the edges of the forest the tips of branches caught fire, makeshift torches, bright enough to illuminate the whole of the valley, though they sputtered beneath their load of snow. Vermund slammed his tail into the ground, and so great was the impact, it shook Ildra off her feet, sent her tumbling forward onto her face. The crusted snow cut her brow, and she grunted as the air rushed from her lungs. Hot blood poured over her eyes, blinding her. She shook her head, sprang back up, and continued running. The Nretch were ripping bleeding chunks from Vermund's scaled length. His natural armor provided little protection against their beaks. His roars acquired a desperate edge, a wounded bull faced with a pair of red-toothed mountain cats, savage and merciless. And still Ildra ran. Her once broken leg lacked strength, her breath burned in her throat. She could barely see the path rising before her, and beside it, the dark crevice of the ravine. A blob of fluttering fire arced past, and she ducked out of instinct. The fire splashed against a nearby rock, a welcome light upon the glittering snow. Below, in the depths of the gorge, her small flock yammered with terror. She heard the pen give way before their panicked efforts, and then the animals fled the confines of the ravine, bleating all the while. She did not mind. Bait they had been. But now they might perhaps survive. At last, Ilgra's destination came in sight, the dam, mantled with cobwebs of silver frost. With loping steps, Ildra climbed the bank and stopped upon the shore of ice-capped water. She stood, panting and coughing, blood streaming from her brow, stood and looked back at the mangled earth, where Vermund and the Nretch still contended in mortal combat. The beasts had pressed Vermund back against the edge of the trees, where the rise of the land toward the mountains limited his movement. Even as Ildra watched, one of the creatures pounced on the dragon's left wing, bearing it to the ground, while the other clawed its way across his ribs until it reached the base of his neck. Vermund writhed in a frantic attempt to shake off his attackers, but the monstrosities kept a firm hold on him. The one clinging to his neck pecked, and the evil old worm coiled in upon himself, hiding his head under his body. The Nretch shrieked with triumph as they closed in on the dragon's exposed side, their wings held high.
"No!"
said Ildra, afraid she'd missed her chance. She could break the dam, but the creatures were too far away to be assured of their deaths, and Vermund's as well. Somehow she had to draw them closer, where the wall of water could do its work. Desperate, Ilgra reached for Vermund with her mind. She found him, but she could not make him understand. The dragon was too addled by pain to notice her feeble thoughts. In comparison to his consciousness, Ilgra was a nothing, a guttering fleck of light beside the raging conflagration that was the dragon's inner being. With a start, Ilgra returned to herself. Convulsions of panic seized her heart. Time was short. If she did not act now, all would be lost. They might finally be rid of Vermund, but in his place they would be left with the Nretch. And the Nretch had not the restraint of the dragon. They would kill every one of the Skagaro and make a nest of their bones upon the crest of Kulkaris. This she knew from the stories. On the claw-torn fields, Vermund thrashed beneath the pecking monstrosities. Then an idea dawned bright and fierce upon Ilgra. The horn had roused the old worm from his sleep and summoned him to the fight. If he heard it again, perhaps he would understand. Perhaps... She took a half-step forward, lifted her father's horn, placed it against her lips, and blew forth with such strength that the echoes chased themselves from one end of the valley to the other. Beyond the village, she saw her clanmates emerge from the fringe of flickering shadow and look toward her hut, frightened, curious, wondering, she felt sure, if her call were a summons. It was, but not for them. Ilgra waved at them to keep back, though she doubted they could see. She hoped they would stay well clear of the ravine, lest they be killed or swept away. She was about to sound the horn a second time, when Vermund uttered a crackling roar and heaved upward, tossing the flapping monstrosities to either side. Battered and wounded though he was, with blood streaming from scores of wounds, the dragon was still stronger by far than either of the Nretch. He staggered forward, each crashing step causing Ilgra to lose her balance and snow to fall in sifting veils from the silent trees. The Nretch shrieked as one and bounded after, throwing themselves at Vermund's neck and shoulders. The dragon snarled and leaped toward the mouth of the ravine, half opening his tattered wings, so his leap became a long glide. As Vermund landed amid the icy drifts within the narrow gorge, he sent a spray of glittering crystals singing upward. And Ilgra knew her moment had arrived. She took her staff then, and with it smote the top of the dam. In a voice terrible to hear, she uttered a single, weirding word. Geirda! Break! The word was a key, with which she unlocked the tempest of power trapped within Gorgoth, and sent the whole whirling confusion into the stones of the dam. The dam cracked and shuddered, and the bank Ilgra stood upon sagged alarmingly. She scrambled back to more solid footing. Granite split with explosive force, and ice too, as the surface of the pool broke asunder, shooting frozen shards in every direction. Then, with a rumble louder than Vermund's deepest roars, the dam gave way. And a wall of water, ice, and wind-felled trees raced down the ravine and slammed into Vermund and the Nretch. The churning torrent washed over the three, enveloping them in a surge of foam, and Ilgra heard the creak and pop of colliding ice and the groan of twisting timber. Beneath the water, huge shapes turned and thrashed, before falling still. The spikes along Vermund's back soon breached the surface. He was too large to stay submerged for long, but they remained where they were, motionless. A stationary sieve that logs and branches fetched up against, until his back was a mound of jagged wood. Ilgra clung to the ground as it rolled beneath her, and she prayed to Rana and Svarvok and all the other gods besides. The water was swift to subside, draining away through the fields to the south, carrying with it a pair of bleating goats. Then Ilgra braced herself on Gorgoth, and slowly got to her feet. She beheld her handiwork. There, in a crumpled heap in the now empty ravine, lay the mighty Vermund, and with him the two monstrosities, one beneath the worm's serrated claws, its neck crooked at an unnatural angle, and one deposited some distance to the east in a tangle of grey-skinned limbs. The vast bellows of Vermund's ribs still moved, but feebly, and the wrinkled old worm otherwise displayed no sign of life. No hint of smoke trailed from his nostrils, no glow of fire emanated from between his gaping jaws, and no sign of movement appeared between his slitted lids. A rising, bursting feel of triumph swelled Ilgra's breast. Now was her chance. If she struck quick and true, she might finally rid the world of Vermund's blight, and finally be avenged of her father's death. She would carve out the worm's blackened heart, and when it was hers, burn it before the gods as thanks for their favor. She hurried down the path along the ravine, moving as fast as her leg would allow. The dragon's breathing was already growing louder. She had only a brief while in which to act. Just as she reached the base of the hill, a voice rang out. "Ilgra!" Her sister ran toward Vermund from the edge of the forest, a knife held high in one hand, teeth bared in a battle face. "Back!" Ilgra shouted, but Yana listened not. She seemed intent on cutting the throat of the dragon herself, and it struck Ilgra then, for the first time, that her sister was no longer a youngling. She was full grown, and as willing to fight as any of the Skagaro. A clutch of conflicting emotions warred within Ilgra, selfishness and concern and surprise. Then she decided, and with her decision came a sense of solidarity. They could kill the dragon together. Before she could call out to Yana again, Ilgra was horrified to see the Farn wretch stir. Rising on broken limbs, it swung its head back and forth, blindly scenting for prey. A jagged shriek tore free of the creature's throat, and it began to scrabble after Yana, dragging its useless wings across the frozen mess of the field. At the sound, a shudder ran the length of Vermund's body, and Ilgra knew if she helped Yana, she would lose all chance of killing the dragon. He would regain his feet, and even wounded and weakened, he still far outmatched them. Ilgra no longer had the great storehouse of energy in Gorgoth to rely upon, only that of her body, and the strength of her body paled in comparison with that of the dragon's. The strain of anguish rent Ilgra's heart, but in the end, there was only one choice. Howling with fear and fury, she charged past the fallen dragon and to her sister's side. As the snapping wretch fell upon them, Ilgra raised Gorgoth, drew upon the reserves of power within her flesh, and shouted, "Brisingr!" A fountain of fire erupted from the end of the staff and bathed the monstrosity's head with a torrent of flame. The wretch recoiled and shrieked again, so loud that Ilgra lost her will, and the fire faded to dark. In that instant, She knew with certainty she was about to die, eaten by a nightmare from ages past, and her sister too, slain by the failure of Ilgra's ambitions. Then the clacking beak of the Nretch stabbed toward them, and the earth shook with sudden violence. A streak of black scales appeared overhead, a foul wind swept the field, and a great crack sounded, frightening, in its deathly finality. Ilgra cowered, covering her sister with her arms. When she dared look again, she saw the black hulk of Vermund standing over them, stark against the swirling snow. And hanging between the worm's enormous jaws, the now limp monstrosity, its body pierced through and through by rows of glistening teeth. The god-killers were slain. For a moment Ilgra felt relief, gratitude even. But both reactions paled before a sickening sense of doom. She had been so close to her desire, so close. And yet, once again, it had slipped her grasp. And now she and Yana were caught beneath the devouring dragon. Vermund snuffed and let fall the grey corpse, obscene in its hairless shape. Then he shook his head as a dog might, and drops of steaming blood rained upon the flood-swept land. One bead, dark and gleaming, splattered across Ilgra's arm, and she cried out as it burned her skin, hot as molten lead. Vermund took notice. He looked down, and then lowered his head, until the blazing void of his eye hung before them, terrifying in its nearness. Ilgra stifled the urge to flee, for they could not hope to outrun the dragon, nor could they hope to best it with blades or wielding. Defiant to the end, she stood her tallest, while Yana clung to her arm. Then Ilgra felt the dragon's mind upon her own, huge and bleak and daunting. From it came no thanks, no approval. No care or consideration. But there was one thought, one impression Ilgra received from the worm. Recognition. No longer was Vermund indifferent. He acknowledged her existence, and from him came a sense of interest, detached and impersonal though it was. He might still view her as prey, but by her actions, Ilgra had earned a measure of regard from the battered old worm. It was no small thing. 7 heartbeats they remained as thus, locked in close embrace. 7 heartbeats only, and then the towering immensity of his mind withdrew, and Vermund snorted, and his hot breath washed over Ilgra in a choking wave of sulphurous scent. Her vision grew blurred, and Ilgra dropped to one knee, faint. Then Vermund stepped over them, the pallid scales of his belly rimmed with twinkling fire from the forest, and the chill of his shadow lifted from their shoulders. Ilgra screwed shut her eyes and stayed where she had fallen, stayed until the ground grew still and the sound of Vermund's tread had faded to a distant toll. It was the touch of her sister's hand that roused her.
Ilgra, he is gone. We are saved.
Only then did she stand and look. The worm had a wounded wing. He could not fly. Instead, he crawled up the face of bold Kulkaris with slow and weary steps, leaving behind a trail of blood and broken trees. He seemed like to fall, never to rise again, and Ilgra wondered if they might yet be freed of him. She had to know. Ere long, the sheets of snow obscured the dragon. Yana tugged on Ilgra's tunic, urged her to leave, said, "You have done all you can. Our father's death is not avenged, but we have honored his memory. There is no more. Come now." But Ilgra refused, preferring to stand and watch and listen to Vermund's painful progress. The order of things was not yet settled. Farther up the valley, the rest of the Skuggaro began to emerge from hiding. Arvog and several of the other warriors trotted out with weapons in hand, joined Ilgra and Yana there on that muddy tract. They checked the Nretch to ensure the monstrosities would bedevil their clan never again. Then they spoke to Ilgra, thanked her, praised her, cajoled her, berated her. But regardless, she would not move. At last they left her, Yana as well, left her, that they might tend their injured and save their belongings from what halls were damaged. And there Ilgra stayed, until she heard the distant sound of talons scraping against stone. And then, from the peak of Kulkaris, Vermund the Grim let loose a mighty roar, and he painted the clouds with fire such that brightened the whole of the night. Then he grew still and silent, and Ilgra knew. The dragon would not die, and they, poor sufferers, would not be rid of him. Ilgra grasped her staff with both hands and leaned upon it. Her heart was too small to contain all her feeling. She shouted after Vermund, though the dragon would not hear, and every part of her was racked with turmoil. Ragged gaps appeared in the snow as the storm began to clear, and through them she saw the crown of Kulkaris, and perched thereon the looming shape of Vermund the Grim. Ilgra stared at him for a silent while. Then she breathed deep of the freezing air, and with her exhale, released her torment. So, one thing had become clear. There would always be a stalking hunger waiting to eat them. If not Vermund, then the monstrosities. If not the monstrosities, then some other equally horrible creature. It was a basic fact of life, as true for the Horned as it was for every other being. None were exempt, not bear, nor wolf, nor cat, nor even the most fearsome of hunters. All fell prey in time. It was not a question of if, but when. Vermund had saved them from the monstrosities. Without him, the Nretch might have slain the entire village. Yet Ilgra knew they could expect no great mercy from him thereafter. It was not in his nature. He would continue to fly down upon them and eat their herds and trample their fields and slaughter those foolish enough to attack him. So it was, and always would be. Someday, Ilgra would again face the dragon. Someday he would come ravening toward her, or else she would once more climb Kulkaris and go to meet him in single combat. It was a certainty. Whenever they met, whether next year or long after her hair turned grey, Ilgra felt sure of one thing, that Vermund would know her and remember her. And though he would give her no quarter, she would at least have the satisfaction of his recognition. But for now, her quest was at an end. The dam was broken, and the pool of water drained. Likewise Gorgoth. And though Vermund was sore wounded, Ilgra no longer had the means or inclination to confront him, not then. Nor did she believe it would do any good. Hurt or not, the dragon was more than a match for her, for the Skuggaro, and even for creatures born of darkest legend, as were the Nretch. A figure came walking from the village, her mother, bearing a blanket and salve for wounds. She wrapped the blanket around Ilgra's shoulders and applied the salve to her arm, where Vermund's blood had burned her raw. Said her mother, "Come now, Ilgra daughter. Leave this unhappy place. Return with me to where you belong." And Ilgra felt as if woken from a dream. She turned her back then, turned her back on the worm resting in his bloody slumber, turned her back on tall, snow-mantled Kulkaris, turned her back on the remnants of the dam and on her hut besides. She turned her back on all those things, and with her mother started the slow walk to the village, leaning upon her staff with every step. No longer would she stand apart. That time had passed. Once again she would join in the clan's daily life. She would claim a mate, she thought, Arvag, perhaps, and bear his children. In all manner possible, she would drink to the dregs each day, and worry not what fate might bring. Ilgra looked at the staff. It was Gorgoth no more, she decided, but rather Warung, or Acceptance. And the now empty sapphire, a legacy in waiting, a potential that she might, with time and effort, restore to its former glory. She straightened her back and bared her teeth, feeling given new purpose. For her name was Ilgra Nretch Slayer. And she feared no evil. Chapter 9. New Beginnings. The last words of Ursk's telling faded to silence in the main hall of the hold, high on Mount Angor. Then the Urgal struck the drum between his knees, and a dull, booming note reverberated off the stone walls, marking an end to the story. Aragorn blinked and rubbed his face, feeling as if he too were waking from a dream. Around the hearth, the rest of the Urgals likewise stirred, statues coming to life. With a growl, Skargarj shoved himself to his feet and strode over to where Ursk sat. He grabbed the smaller Urgal by the horns and with a violent, jerking motion, butted him in the head. The Urgals roared with laughter, and Skargarj said,
"Well done, Ursk, well said. You do your clan proud."
The impact knocked Ursk back, but he bared his teeth in a fierce grin, and with just as much vigor, butted Skargarj in return.
"Honor for the clan, Nar Skargarj."
The fire had burned down to a bed of coals, and a chill had crept into the air while Ursk told his tale. Aragorn glanced out the windows, wondering at the hour. The sky was black, without so much as a glimmer of the silver moon, and even the round-eyed owls that roosted in the dark pine trees were silent in their nests. It was late, far later than he made a habit of staying up, but he didn't mind. "That was a most excellent story, Ursk," he said, and bowed as best he could while sitting. "Thank you." He understood now why the Carl had requested that particular story, and Aragorn was glad of it. It seemed there was always something for him to learn, even from the Urgals.
"What did you think?" he asked Saphira.
Approval radiated from her.
"I liked Ilgra. And I liked Vermund even more. It is only right that the dragon would win."
Aragorn smiled slightly. Then he said out loud, "Was that a true story?"
"Of course it was a true story," exclaimed Skargarj, stomping back to his chair. We would not tell you a story that said wrong things about the world, Ryder.
No, I mean, did it really happen? Did Ildra actually exist? And Vermund, and the mountain Kulkaris? Skargaj scratched his chin, a thoughtful look in his yellow eyes.
It is an old story, Ryder. Perhaps going back to the time before our kind crossed the sea. But I think the story happened as it says. Even to this day, the Ulgragra often name their daughter Zilgra, and because of her, every one of us knows that there is a Vermund we cannot best. It is a good lesson to learn, I think.
A good lesson indeed, said Aragorn. In some ways, he had defeated his own Vermund in the person of Galbatorix, but there were still things in life he could not overcome, things that no one could. It was a sobering thought. When Aragorn was younger, the knowledge would have bothered him to no end. Now, though, he understood the wisdom of acceptance. Even if it didn't make him happy, it at least gave him peace, and that was no small gift. Happiness, Aragorn had decided, was a fleeting, futile thing to pursue. Contentment, on the other hand, was a far more worthwhile goal. The Anointed, he said, are those...
What in our tongue we call the Cull, said Ursk.
Aragorn had thought as much. And the Nretch, they are Leatherblucker? A shadow seemed to descend upon the hall as he named the creatures. Skargaj coughed.
Gah! Yes, if you must speak of the blasted things, yes. We are fortunate you killed the last of them, Ryder. And you as well, dragon.
He nodded towards Saphira, who blinked once in return. If we are so lucky, said Aragorn under his breath. Many a night he still wondered about Galbatorix's claim to have hidden more of the Razak's eggs throughout Alagazia. For Razak, once grown, transformed into Leatherblucker, as caterpillars into butterflies. Even with all Aragorn knew of magic, the thought of having to again face the creatures, Razak or Leatherblacker both, was unsettling indeed. A commotion sounded at the back of the hall, and at the same time he sensed a disturbance among the Eldenari in the Hall of Colours. Alarmed, he struggled to his feet. Saphira hissed and did the same, her claws scrabbling on the floor. Blodgarm, Aestrith, Rielven, and the rest of the elves hurried toward them from across the hall. The elves were smiling, beautiful, broad, white-toothed smiles, and their steps were quick and light. It was such a contrast with their usual decorum, Aragorn wasn't sure how to react. He would have found scowls and blank, impassive expressions far less unnerving.
Ebrithil, said Blodgarm.
The midnight blue fur along his shoulders rippling with excitement.
What's wrong?
Said Aragorn. Behind him he heard stomps and clatters as the Urgals gathered in ranks, as if they expected the elves to attack. At the same time the minds of the Eldenari were a riot of conflicting words, thoughts, images and emotions, a storm of sensations that made Aragorn wince and that defied his attempts to decipher. Saphira shook herself and growled, baring her long white fangs. Blodgarm's smile widened, and he laughed in a delighted fashion.
Nothing is wrong, Ebrithil. Quite the opposite, in fact. Everything is right with the world.
Then Aestrith said,
One of the eggs has hatched.
Aragorn blinked.
One of... A dragon has hatched, Ebrithil, said Blodgarm. Another dragon is born.
Saphira craned back her neck and crowed toward the shadowed ceiling, and the Urgals stomped and shouted until the entire hall rang with the sounds of celebration. Aragorn grinned, and he threw his cup over his head and let loose with an entirely undignified whoop. All of their hard work, all of the late nights and early mornings, the spells that left him exhausted, and the endless worrying about provisions and politics and people, all of it had been worth it. A new beginning had dawned for the dragons. Names and Languages. On the Origin of Names. To the casual observer, the various names an intrepid traveller will encounter throughout Alagasia might seem but a random collection, with no inherent integrity, culture, or history. However, as with any land that different groups, and in this case different species, have repeatedly colonized, Alagasia acquired names from a wide array of unique sources, among them the languages of the dwarves, elves, humans, and even Urgals. Thus we can have Palankar Valley, a human name, the Anora River and Ristvak Bain, elven names, and Utgard Mountain, a dwarven name, all within a few square miles of each other. While this is of great historical interest, practically it often leads to confusion as to the correct pronunciation. Unfortunately, there are no set rules for the neophyte. You must learn each name upon its own terms, unless you can immediately place its language of origin. The matter grows even more confusing when you realize that in many places the resident population altered the spelling and pronunciation of foreign words to conform to their own language. The Anora River is a prime example. Originally, Anora was spelt A with umlaut, E-N-O-R-A, which means broad in the ancient language. In their writings, the humans simplified the word to Anora, A-N-O-R-A, and this, combined with a vowel shift wherein A with umlaut, E, Ea, was said as the easier A, E, created the name as it appears in Aragon's time. The enthusiast is encouraged to study the source languages in order to master their true intricacies. Afterword. From Christopher. Kvetha Frikea. Greetings, friends. It's been a while. This was an unplanned-for book. A bit over 2 years ago, I wrote the first version of The Worm of Kulkaris as a means of clearing my head between sections of a larger sci-fi project. Although I was pleased with it, Worm by itself was too short to publish. Thus it sat on my computer, alone and abandoned, until the summer of 2018. At that point, I got an urge to write a story about Murtagh I'd long had in mind. This became a fork in the road. I sent both that and Worm off to my editor at Knopf. Meanwhile, my sister Angela proposed writing a vignette from her character's point of view. And hey presto, before I knew it, we were in talks to release this anthology that same year. For those of you not familiar with publishing, that is a highly accelerated schedule. I'd always imagined returning to Alagasia with a full-sized novel. However, doing it this way made for a wonderful experience. Getting to dip into the heads of some of the characters from the inheritance cycle, as well as a few new ones, was a real treat for me. Writing about Aragorn and Saphira after so many years was like returning home after a long journey. Plus, I finally proved to myself that I could turn out a book that was shorter than 500 pages. Success! This is Gerard Doyle. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Fork, the Witch and the Worm, Tales from Alagasia, Volume 1, Aragon, by Christopher Paolini, with Angela Paolini writing as Angela the Herbalist in On the Nature of Stars. This program was directed by Taro Meyer, executive producer Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2018 by Christopher Paolini. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.